It's the Podmatic Podcast for September 24th, 2014. Banned Books Week. Around here, it's banned books all year.
I love banned books. Podmatic.
This is the Podmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I'm Brian, and joining me today are...
Crystal.
Bill.
Mike.
Amanda, as always.
It's true, we're right in the middle of Banned Books Week. This is the week when libraries and communities all around the country celebrate their freedom to read. Hopefully you celebrate their freedom to read every week on the Podmatic Podcast, but specifically during Banned Books Week... We highlight books that have been banned or challenged or attempted to have been banned around the country. So just so we let you know what you've been missing. So every year, the American Library Association puts out a list of the most challenged books. So these are books that have been banned or at least have been attempted to have been banned in libraries and schools across America. So just real fast. Mike, I don't know if you know about this one. Bone from Jeff Smith coming in at number 10.
No, that's a great book.
Bless Me Ultima by Rodolfo Anaya. Why? The Perks of Being a Wildflower by...
Wallflower.
Yes. The Perks of Being a Perks of Being a Wallflower by Stephen Chbosky.
Jacob Dylan's overrated.
Looking for Alaska by John Green. It's become one of the hated books. A Bad Boy Can Be Good for a Girl by Tanya Lee Stone. Ooh. That's been off the list for a few years, but it makes a proud return. The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. Never heard of that one. The 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James, never heard of that one. Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian by Sherman Alexie. The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. And, of course, number one for the second year in a row. Does anybody know?
The Happy Hooker Goes to Hollywood.
That one was just an honorable mention.
The kids' version, Captain Underpants.
Wow.
It's way off base.
by Dav Pilkey. I'd rather read Bill's pick. Second year in a row.
Different kind of underpants.
Banned books, who's going to start?
I want to start.
Who fights censorship the hardest?
Kapow.
Amanda does.
Captain and me and Captain Underpants fighting banned book crime.
Censoring censors.
So I have to admit that my high school did not have the strongest literature program. And there are lots of books in this world that I'm, finger quotes, supposed to have read, but I haven't, which includes a good chunk of the books on the banned list, like Catcher in the Rye and The Color Purple and Lord of the Flies. And while I'm really pretty sure that I will not be reading that last one probably ever, there are some that intrigue me, Lolita being one of them. I went through and like surveyed people on how you say the author's name. We've had a lot of discussions, but the official Wikipedia version, his name is Vladimir Nabokov. He likes moose and squirrel.
Duh.
He was Russian-born, but Lolita is written in English because he moved to America and was writing. Now, because I get all of my information from pop culture sources, I was under the impression, I think like most people, that Lolita is about this skanky chick who tries to seduce an older man and, you know, goes after him. But it's really the other way around. Like, the protagonist in the story, Humbert, which is obviously...
I love that name.
Yeah, a pseudonym. tells the story. He's the one that's obsessed with the young girls, and then he targets in on his stepdaughter, Lolita. So he's the seducer, not the seducee, which I thought that was interesting to me just because I've grown up with it being the other way around in my brain for some reason. Lolita was finished in 1953. It took him about 5 years to write it. And because of its subject matter, though, obviously no American publisher would touch it at the time. And he finally found a publisher in France called the Olympia Press. And apparently their catalog list was made up of a large quantity of questionable literature, if you will.
It was really good stuff.
Yeah, it was, yeah. So and I don't know that he knew that at the time, but he was just happy to find a publisher. The first printing of 5,000 copies sold out, but it was just kind of under the radar. Nobody was really caring about this book until Graham Greene called it the best book of 1955 in the London Sunday Times. And then, like, everybody started freaking out. British customs officials stopped allowing copies to enter the UK. They were seizing all of them that were coming in. And then in 1956, France actually banned the book. And it was banned for 2 years. And then in 1959, they published it in London and caused such a scandal that basically ended the political career of one of the publishers. He's like, I'm publishing it anyway, and it didn't work for him. American didn't really ban it in publication. It published in August of 1958, and it was into the third printing within days and became the first book since Gone with the Wind, which came out in 1938, to sell 100,000 copies in its first 3 weeks. So it was very popular in the United States. Since then, it has been repeatedly challenged, obviously, on the basis of potential obscenity, pornographic nature, but it has also influenced, besides just putting Lolita into pop culture, a large amount of other works of art. For example, in 1999, the film American Beauty came out, which is creepy old guy played by Kevin Spacey seduces his daughter's friend, and some have claimed that the cheerleading scene in American Beauty is directly derived from the tennis scene in Lolita, which I didn't know. In the Police song, Don't Stand So Close to Me, about a schoolgirl's crush on her teacher, the final verse actually says, the teacher starts to shake and cough just like that old man in that book by Nabokov. So that's a direct reference to Lolita. And then just as kind of a companion piece, I had started reading the book Reading Lolita in Tehran, which is a memoir about a college professor in Iran teaching at a university, trying to teach Western literary classics. And you can imagine if this book has been banned in America and France and the West, imagine what the Islamic Republic of Iran does with it. So it's pretty good. They also talk about some Henry James, some other, The Great Gatsby, she mentions, trying to teach. But Lolita in particular is dubbed as the ultimate forbidden novel. And kind of she makes it a metaphor, the author, Azar Nafisi, makes it a metaphor for life in Iran during the 1980s. Kind of rowdy. Glad I read it. You can check that one off my supposed to have read list.
My husband liked the book so much he named his kitten Lolita.
Oh, nice.
Now she's 15 years old.
Oh,
so she's
wow.
Not a young,
which is
precocious
the,
kitten.
Yeah. That's the perfect that age for.
Yeah. Yeah, Nabokov is the only author who died before I was born that I had to say that he wrote a new book. We put a new sticker on it and everything.
Because, yeah, they had some. He had one that was unfinished, I guess, that his son actually, they put out in 2008 or 2009.
Yeah, that's it. And it's interesting, too, because he didn't actually write, like, a manuscript. It was all on
note cards.
Yeah, so they printed it with, like, a note card edition that you can actually, like, tear out.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Well, it's not cool for libraries.
Fair enough.
But I rose an objection downstairs and was overruled, so we may not have it anymore. But we did at one point.
We have one version of it for sure. And it was controversial, too, because Nabokov really, really didn't want that. He was really explicit, like, that he never wanted that published, but his son felt that there had been enough time when it went by that it didn't matter anymore.
Yeah, I remember that being, like, a scandal at the time.
I think Nabokov just didn't want it published because it was unfinished, you know, and he was meticulous about his work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he even was the Russian translator for Lolita because it was written in English, so he's the one that translated it to Russian just because he's like, I can't let somebody else do this because they would completely lose the nuances.
Yeah, interesting. All right, well, today I thought I'd talk about the autobiography of Malcolm X by Malcolm X and Alex Haley. Normally I try to talk about fun, light, fluffy stuff, but today it's something super serious. I'm trying not to be giggles. Basically, I've talked about a little too much about a certain author that I read way back in college who I'll not mention now. But today I thought I'd talk about the best book that I was assigned in college for religious studies class. It's been some years since I read it, and I hope that I get all the details right. The autobiography details Malcolm X's life from when he was Malcolm Little, right before, you know, I think it starts before he was born, when he became a petty criminal in his youth, to when he joined the Nation of Islam while in prison. He quickly rose through the ranks of the organization to become their chief spokesman and eventually left the church to convert to full-on Sunni Islam. It was part of the religious studies, part of the reason why it was assigned was to teach us the difference between the Nation of Islam and Sunni and Shiite Islam that actually is quite different than the American version. He eventually went on the Hajj or the pilgrimage to Mecca, and it changed his life. And he came back less militant, I suppose. And then just as he's about to really get on to talk about his conversion and his outlook on philosophy, he was assassinated. One of the things that really struck me throughout the years is that it's probably the most angry book I've ever read. I've never really read such a rage-filled book, especially specifically to me, a dopey white dude.
Welcome to the party.
Yeah. Wow. So this is what white privilege is. He was the spokesman for the Nation of Islam, and you really get the sense that he saw this as a promotional tool, at least at first. But one of the neat things of the book is that it was composed through a series of interviews. So as the book progresses, the tone of the book shifts. That, you know, he starts out very angry, and then by the end, he just, you know, I mean, it really, you know, the pilgrimage changed him. I mean, he talks about seeing blonde, blue-eyed Muslims on the pilgrimage, which just blew his mind. You know, you just begin to wonder, like, by the end of the book, just what would have happened had he lived? Because, I mean, really, there's like a, you know, an arc there that is like, you know. One reviewer, again on the aforementioned Amazon, had this really neat thing in his review, because the arc of the story from the gutter to a redemptive anger to cleansing understanding to violent death is like something from Greek myth or Shakespeare, but is a uniquely American tragedy. People have tried to ban the book. Basically, the reasons for the banning are supposedly because they call it a how-to manual for crime, even though his criminal stuff was in the 50s. So I don't, you know, what are you going to, like, rob train cars? And it's decried for the anti-white statements, which, yeah, it's quite an eye-opener in that way. So that's a free. What do you got, Bill?
Well, I'll just start out by saying, here are the commandments of animalism. Whatever goes upon two legs is the enemy. Whatever goes upon four legs or has wings is a friend. No animal shall wear clothes. No animal shall sleep in a bed. No animal shall drink alcohol. No animal shall kill any other animal. All animals are equal. The book I'm talking about, of course, is Animal Farm by George Orwell. Animal Farm is an allegory of the events leading up to the Russian Revolution of 1917 and then into the Stalin era in the Soviet Union, this according to George Orwell himself. It's funny, when I first read the book, it's been 40 years ago, I thought it was a satire on human nature. I remember listening to the CD audiobook a couple of years ago, and I see it now as the old adage goes, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I read you the commandments of animalism, and if you've read the book, the commandments become revised to clear certain animals of accusations of law-breaking. Gee, that sounds awfully familiar. In doing research, George Orwell's original title was Animal Farm, a Fairy Story, and come to think of it, Animal Farm reads like a children's story, which gives Mr. Orwell's story its perverse charm, in my opinion. Sorry about my ramblings. What I'm trying to point out is Animal Farm can be many things to whoever reads it. I guess what I'm trying to say is give Animal Farm a chance by George Orwell and see what it means to you. And don't let anybody tell you not to.
Well, I would say about Animal Farm, too, before we go on, I know that we have an illustrated version. This huge, it looks like a children's book.
I read where the publisher's daughter loved it. Mm-hmm. She just loved the book when, you know, it was like a children's story to her. But Orwell wanted to write it in that type of way so it would be like a lot of medicine, easy to swallow for a large group of people. Crystal.
Awesome. So, books written for kids, tweens, and teens that explain puberty and human sexuality are often challenged and even banned from libraries. Although those who question these kinds of books are coming from a place of love and concern, maybe a desire to shelter and protect, the fact remains that a well-informed young adult is a young adult who makes smart and sound decisions about their emotional and physical well-being. Here are a couple of embarrassing examples to illustrate my point. When I was a little girl, I found out my cousin's wife was pregnant when I asked about her growing belly. Well, this was very distressing. I was chubby, and I had a growing belly. Suddenly, I feared I must be pregnant, too. After a few terrifying days, I found out through a crude conversation on the school bus that I was definitely in the clear.
That's cool of us, man. What would you do about it?
But then I felt a kick.
But had I read the picture book Mommy Laid an Egg by Babette Cole, I would have never experienced an irrational pregnancy scare. In Cole's book, parents tell their children silly stories about how babies are made, such as dinosaurs delivering babies to your doorstep, and seeds you plant in your garden that sprout children. The kids end up educating their parents as to how babies are really made. Mommy Laid an Egg is one of those books that's highly entertaining for adults, while kids find it funny and also educational. I bought a copy for my sister upon the birth of my nephew, who is now 16 years old. I sure hope she's read it to him. Okay. Embarrassing example number two. Some of those same wise older kids on the school bus told me that to increase your bust, wear a bra 24 hours a day, and you're guaranteed to increase at least 2 cup sizes.
It's magic.
Well, for a whole year, I faithfully wore my bra morning, noon, and night, only taking it off to shower.
That's imbra-believable.
I like that. That wasn't even in the script. Anyway, I think I even tried to wear it under my bathing suit. But at some point towards the end of that year, I realized how ridiculous I'd been to listen to the same kid who had kindly tripped me, so I stepped in vomit.
Mm. Come to think of it. You had a great school bus.
Yeah, geez, wow. Listen to no one.
This was back when they just put sawdust on the vomit, so
it's pretty fresh. Gross. It's okay.
Gross. Turn it into oatmeal.
Yeah. I think that kid may have had a crush on me, to be honest, but anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
Had I read What's Happening to My Body, a book for girls, I would have known how ludicrous it was to think that wearing a bra was the miracle cure for a small chest. This book has been published a number of times. There's also a version for boys. The author, Linda Medeiros, objectively relates and answers all sorts of body and sex-related questions. Things kids are just too embarrassed to ask you about, but things so incredibly vital to know for a happy, healthy, and safe coming of age. I'm not an expert on raising kids. I'm just a middle-aged librarian who had an incredibly awkward childhood. But I do know that books are a perfect way to start those difficult conversations. So read together, talk about and critique what you're reading, impart your own personal wisdom, but keep your kids informed. It could save them from making irresponsible and unsafe decisions concerning their emotional and physical health. All right, Brian.
I just want to go off on all my pregnancy scare stories that I have personally.
My next joke was you can ban books together with your kids.
Well, there you go. Yeah. No. Don't go there.
Okay, so actually the book that I wanted to talk about today was Little Brother by Cory Doctorow, which I have talked about on the podcast a few years ago. But since then, it's been challenged out of school. The first is to refresh her about what happens in the plot. Marcus and his friends are playing this augmented reality, massive multiplayer online role-playing game. And what that means is, like, you do stuff on the computer, but then you also have to go do things in real life. Find things or meet people, like a specific location in a city and that kind of thing. So he and his friends go to this one place in San Francisco that they need to, like, get some sort of victory condition in a game. But when they're there, there's actually a terrorist attack on the BART. Now, they're all dressed up in black hoodies, because that's the uniform for the game that they're all playing. But the cops mistake them for suspects, and they all get rounded up. Now, Marcus and his friends get released, except for their friend Daryl. So then after that, Marcus and his friends have to figure out where Daryl is and help him escape. Now, it's called Little Brother because it's actually a play on George Orwell's novel
1984,
where Big Brother is basically Napoleon the Pig of 1984. What the kids do is they use their tech skills, which is like way higher than the adults in the book, and they have to figure out where Daryl is without tipping off the government that they're looking for him, so they have to beat government surveillance. And it's a fun story, but there's also a lot of like real world lessons about computer hacking and encryption and privacy and things, cool things you can do with your phone and cool ways you can hack your Xbox and create your own virtual private network, that kind of thing. And actually, I think it's taken Cory Doctorow a little while to find his voice as a writer. And I think where he's actually found his voice is in young adult novels where he actually teaches kids ideas about technology. And it took him a while to find that voice. Just this summer, Little Brother had been approved at the Booker T. Washington High School in Pensacola, Florida, for the One Book, One Read program. So, like, every middle school student would read this book, and the head of the English department and the head librarian for the school district had chosen this book and made a reader's guide and everything. And then, like, the week before the program was supposed to start, the principal just canceled the whole program because he had read that Little Brother had anti-authoritarian themes in it. The reason that he just canceled the whole program is that there probably was actually like a book challenge procedure that you're supposed to follow and everything. And like, he didn't want to do that. He's the principal. So he just canceled the whole program. So, but of course, Cory Doctorow is kind of like the king of the internet. Like an equivalent would be like if John Green was a computer hacker. It's like the one person is like the head of the English department contacted Cory Doctorow and he made a huge stink. And everyone found out about this book being banned. Now, I don't think that the principal's decision got reversed, but Tor, the book's publisher, like I said before, this is the modus operandi when a book gets challenged or banned out of school. They just flood the school district with free copies of the book. So Tor still gave all kinds of books to the kids in the school. And then the doctor himself actually donated some autographed copies of some small press deluxe edition of the book for them to auction off at their school charity. And then the details are sealed because of some privacy concerns or some legal concerns. But the teacher that spoke out about the program being canceled, someone somewhere tried to get her fired, and there was a hearing, but the superintendent of the school district ruled in her favor, and she got to keep her job. And this just went down in August. So again, like, if you're going to try to censor a book, don't try to censor the king of the internet's book. It's funny, too, because he gives all his books away for free anyway.
I was totally going to mention that, yeah. So like, they could get it, you know, online for free.
Exactly.
You know, legally.
Now, I said I've mentioned this book, Little Brother, before on the podcast. Well, it's actually a sequel. I've been holding out to read the sequel, so I've been waiting to get it on audio because the reader on the audio version is Will Wheaton. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that's worth waiting for. I want to hear Will Wheaton. And then, though I've read many of Cory Doctorow's novels, and I pitch the ones I like here on the podcast, I think it's nonfiction where I think he's a better writer. I think he's an idea man. I don't necessarily know if he's a great novelist. But his new nonfiction book, Information Does Not Want to Be Free, you know, his latest collection of essays about technology and copyright, on order now at the library. And you can put a hold on that. You can put a hold on Little Brother. You can put a hold on Homeland, the sequel to Little Brother, and also his new nonfiction book, Information Does Not Want to Be Free. Check it out.
I just think it's always interesting, like, especially in that case, that the principal's like, no, you can't. We're not doing this. Like, don't you think the students in that school, like, then that's all they want to read?
Exactly.
I mean, because that's what would be me. You know, if someone said, you can't read that, I'm like, well, I'm going to read it.
Well, yeah.
Often in book challenges, the people that challenge the books have not read the books.
That's true.
That's not always the case, but often.
It is.
Yeah. Well, in this case, it is funny that the principal was pretty open about the fact that he didn't read the book.
Mm-hmm.
He just had read reviews of it. It's funny because the book actually got good reviews.
Yeah.
But in those reviews, he read that the book had anti-authoritarian themes, which is funny because so does Animal Farm.
Yeah. There's a,
and okay. So does 1984. And
yeah,
so
Captain
does,
Underpants.
So does the autobiography of Malcolm X, right? So
mine doesn't.
Well,
it portrays an authority figure as kind of gross.
I think it just depends, right? What's anti-authoritarian theme, right?
Yeah.
I think Little Brother too would be a great book for discussion because there's been changes in legislation about your phone and phone privacy from the time that book has been published, because that's actually one of the things that the book is about. Since Little Brother was published and all these issues, there have been two, I'm not sure if it was a Supreme Court ruling, it might have just been federal appeals court ruling that, you know, you can be thrown in jail if you don't give up your encryption keys or your phone password. Like, so if your phone is, you know, if you have a PIN number on your phone or your data is encrypted even on your personal devices like a phone, if a judge orders you to give those up in the course of it and you don't, like, you can be punished for that legally. But also, so some people think that that's bad news. So in a ruling that some people think is good news, though, the Supreme Court has ruled now that you have to have a warrant to search someone's phone. So you can't just take someone's, because they realize that their phone is basically like a computer. Mm-hmm. So you can't just take it and search it without a warrant, that it, you know, that technology has changed. And those are two rulings that are like directly about what Little Brother is about. Would have been great for teens to discuss over the summer. Mike, what's tickling your fancy this week?
So, I thought I'd talk about something completely different than the one I was talking about earlier. Ever since Brian floated the idea of a weekly podcast, I was like, that means during October I could do Tickle My Fancy every week of horror stuff. Mwah. Mwah. Now, don't look at your calendars, though, because it's still September, but I thought that I would whip out a terrorizing appetizer to Shocktober, an appetizerizer called The Colony by A.J. Colucci. So movies that are so bad they're good, like The Room or Plan 9 or Birdemic or, you know, your usual, have been very popular of late. But what of books that are so bad they're good? I've read a few. Today, oh man, The Colony is like if Michael Crichton got high and did all his research in Wikipedia before scribbling on crayon a book about giant ants. It's, It is great. It's a colony. It's about a colony of genetically engineered giant ants that take over New York City. And by giant, I mean the size of like a pinky, but, you know, less than like, you know, it's not like them. It's more like they're bigger than normal. So I forget the exact whole, like, kind of suits that he wears. I want to say Versace. He wears Versace suits. A Versace suit fetishist slash regularly handsome entomologist, Paul O'Keefe, is summoned.
Sorry.
This is just the beginning of the joy that is the colony. Is summoned to solve the mounting giant ant problem. He brings in his stunningly beautiful, like, isn't when she's introduced, it said that all her grad students instantly fall in love with her beauty and, of course, her vast insect expertise. Ex-wife Kendra Hart to go help him. My favorite line in the whole book, the mayor of New York City was so worried when he traveled in an open-top Jeep because Paul O'Keefe was so internationally famous and renowned that people would swarm the car. Because, you know, I know lots of internationally famous entomologists. Also, oh, yeah, the favorite, like, bit in the book is where, like, Paul and Kendra, like, you know, get back together. And, you know, like, oh, Paul. This is my lady voice. Oh, Paul, I love you. I know that you'll pay attention to me and not your career anymore. But now what we do about the giant killer ants?
That's a fair question. I'm sorry.
That was amazing. I laughed so hard I had tears. It's, oh. After watching Phase 4 at the Belcourt this year, I stayed afterward for the Skype call from an entomology expert. And one of the central premises of this stupid book is that the queens use hormones to compel the ants to attack people. And the real-life expert said that queens are actually, in real life, more like a uterus than a brain. You know, they don't think. So it's like, you know... you know, an ant colony is more like cells in a body than like, you know, like a hive intelligence. And I'm just going to spoil part of the end of the night. Not the very end, but close to the end. So, you know, if you want to like, you know, I know you're dying to read the book before. Yeah, you know, just. So it turns out that the the genetically engineered ants were an army super weapon. And the army doesn't want to kill them because we'll have an ant gap. That other nations like Russia, China will, and I'm not kidding you, these are lines in the book. Russia, China will create their own killer ants to attack us, and we won't have killer ants to attack them.
Just thinking ahead right there. Oh, thinking ahead.
This book, oh, you know, by the end I'm like, this guy's either a mad genius or, again, you know, Michael Crichton on high writing on crayon. I laughed in nearly every page. Now, there are some bits that are actually genuinely scary. But the silly stuff kind of outweighs it. Highest recommendation I could have, The Colony by A.J. Colucci.
Forget The Grapes of Wrath, I'm reading.
Yeah. What have you got, Crystal?
Tickling my fancy this week is The Cure's cover of the Beatles tune Hello, Goodbye, recorded with Sir Paul's son James McCartney on keyboards. Hello, Goodbye is the first cover release that will be featured on a collection called The Art of McCartney. It drops November 18th, so be on the lookout for that in our catalog later this year. For now, enjoy the video of The Cure and James McCartney recording the song. Robert Smith has talked about his childhood adoration of the Beatles, so it must be a big thrill for him to be included in this collection. And he certainly looks really happy and joyful in the video, which makes me happy and joyful. All right, Bill, what you got?
Tickling my fancy, I'll be brief. I'm a huge fan of comedian Lewis Black. Mr. Black first came to my attention when he appeared on Comedy Central The Daily Show doing his Back in Black, in which he would rant and rave against the political hypocrisy of the day. Well, I'm proud to say that the library has two brand new DVDs, Lewis Black, Stark Raving Mad, and Lewis Black in God We Rust. So if you like your humor acidic, I'm highly recommending In God We Rust and Stark Raving Mad by Lewis Black. Amanda, what's tickling your fancy?
Tuesdays on Spotify are New Music Tuesdays. And yesterday I was just listening to the playlist playing through, and there's usually just a bunch of stuff I don't care about. But this one track came on, and I was like, that's really cool. So I was, you know, checking it out. And it's new music by Ben Howard, which I have never heard of him before. He is an English. He was born in South Devon, England. He grew up on folk music. His music is kind of folky. He actually moved to Newquay, which is the surf capital of the UK, where he studied journalism and worked at a surfing magazine.
There's a surf capital of the UK.
Apparently,
the
UK. Newquay.
Yeah, you don't really think of, you know.
I mean,
UK
I guess their
surfing.
Coast is pretty. Yeah, I don't know.
Is it like bleak and dark? But there's like, you know.
There's like one little wave.
Yeah.
So, if anyone who knows me knows that I enjoy surfing things. So that it piqued my curiosity. And his surf buddies actually convinced him to stop studying journalism and pursue his songwriting full time. So he did in 2008. And he kind of had this built-in following because all these surf guys would come to all his shows and like pack the audience. And so he put out two EPs called These Waters and Old Pine, which got him to the attention of Island Records. So in 2011, he signed with them and then released his first full-length album called Every Kingdom, which I looked, and we actually have it on Hoopla, so you can listen to it if you would like. It's really, it's folk music, and I mean, you think it's they call it English surf music, and I don't, I think surf music, I think the Beach Boys, and it's not like that at all. It's really mellow, it's this big acoustic sound, and it's really ambient. Part of it reminds me of another singer I like called, his name is Dave Tate. Part of it reminds me of like the Plain White Tees, kind of like that Hey There Delilah song.
Hot sand on toes, cold sand in sleeping bags. I come to know that memories were the best things you ever had. The summer shorn, beat down on bony backs. So far from home where the ocean stood, down dust and pine bone.
I just kind of want to get in a room and just kind of let the ambient sound like just kind of wash around me. It's just, I'm going to have to listen to it more. I've only been listening to it, you know, for one day, but I really enjoyed it. So that is Ben Howard, Every Kingdom. Check it out on Hoopla.
It's a good chill music.
Yeah, it kind of, I mean, it really kind of is. And I haven't really listened to the words to really get the message behind his music. I just like the sound at this point, but.
When I think of surf rock, I think of Dick Dale and his Deltones.
Yeah, that's what I thought of, too.
Wipeout.
Yeah. Well, not that either.
Beach Boys is a cleaned up version of that.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
So speaking of things that need to be censored, I wanted to tell you about Brooke Candy, who we touched on a little bit in the last couple episodes. So Grimes got had this video called Genesis, and in it, there is this girl with like long pink cornrows in a metal bikini armor, like sort of walking around, whipping her hair around.
And yeah, I remember that.
And some people, I think Greg included in the episode, were confused that.
R.I.P. Greg.
Yeah, Greg.
Wait, Greg did not die. Greg just switched jobs.
Greg called me.
Shed a single tear.
Greg called me from Antioch. He says the mall is overrun with zombies. And stay away, but they're running low on ammunition.
That's what you get when you move to Antioch, though.
So the chick in the metal bikini is actually Brooke Candy, who's a rapper and a model. After that video, her career really took off because everybody wanted to know.
As a rapper or as a model?
Both. Oh, both at the same time.
That
so,
worked out well.
Well, I think she was releasing music at the same time and mm-hmm. She'd been actually in a couple of movies and everything, right? But her profile just really took off after that video. She eventually got signed to Sony because of this, and her new EP, her first EP on a big major label, Opulence, is out now, and you can. She's on Sony, so you can get it on Freegal. Basically, like techno rap party music. Now, I think there's this really interesting dichotomy between her pre-major label stuff and her post-major label stuff. Her pre-major label stuff is like really incredibly dirty, and like I can't link to any of it on the podcast, and like a lot rougher around the edges, and arguably more fun. The major label stuff where they got in the studio with some other producers, like it's a lot cleaner, it's a lot more like pop music. Somewhere along the line, too, she was friends or is friends with Nikolai Formichetti, who was the creative director, fashion designer, a lot of Lady Gaga's early videos. And they did a video together for Opulence, the title track off this EP. Now, she says that Opulence is a critique of Opulence. I think that's debatable. If you listen to the song and watch the video, and it's funny, is the video is actually pretty tame compared to her other videos. But it is interesting, and I think it's a testament to the continuing cultural influence of Kenneth Anger. Totally just rips off Kenneth Anger. But Nikolai Formichetti was the creative director on the video. You can see that like crazy, completely over the top look. Brooke Candy, Opulence. Corrections!
Hello.
Mike said he was going to link to an article, but the article is not on the internet anymore.
Nope.
Yeah.
Ironically, it's still like up on the place where it originally posted, like the heading, but the article itself isn't there. The only reason I bring this up, because the site where it is posted is NPR's Monkey See blog, which, you know, we basically stole the format of their podcast, Pop Culture Happy Hour. I don't know if this is a correction, but I was talking about Richard Rodriguez. And
Robert Rodriguez.
Boom! I'm leaving that in because the whole way, like half the time I said Richard Rodriguez when the dude's name is Robert Rodriguez. Now half the other time I said it right. So the times I said Richard, I just had to go back in and like cut and paste the correct name. And of course, it sounds like poop.
Wasn't that the Night Stalker? The serial killer?
That was Richard Ramirez.
Oh, well then. So, all right. Correction to a correction to a correction.
Yeah. Further down. Her
Brian knows his
rabbit
serial
hole.
Killer.
So
this is something about him he doesn't want to tell us.
He has those trading cards.
So the reason it sounded funky was because I kept saying the wrong name and had to go back and paste it back in. So I'm revealing the curtain. But for more information about theater curtains and things like that, you can go to...
We're still going to say
www.library.asheville.gov.
Oh!
.org.
He forgot to bring his cheat sheet this week.
Yeah. I'll get it right one of these days about the cheat sheet.
Just remember SeaQuest, which will remind you of Sea Org. The Scientology elite organization.
I never watched SeaQuest.
I watched SeaQuest.
I never watched
But that's how you can remember Org, is because you can remember SeaQuest, and then you remember Sea Org.
I would think it was that DSP.
I'm watching Babylon 5 now.
Oh, it's a great show. Yes. Oh, I love that show. I've watched it multiple times.
All of the Star Trek sequels, like, or whatever, like, after Next Generation, are all this, like, crappy photocopy degeneracy, horrible version of the one before.
Wow.
Except for Deep Space Nine, which was a horrible photocopy degeneracy carbon copy version of Babylon 5.
Yeah, if you listen to J. Michael Straczynski, the creator of Babylon 5, he openly says that when he gave Paramount the idea for Babylon 5, they're like, that's okay, we'll pass. And then like within months, they're like, Deep Space Nine!
Oh, yeah. Come on, really strong.
Adam Dean!
I love it. So I was reading this book, and one of the characters in this book said there were no good cartoons made since the 1990s. True, untrue?
True.
I don't know. I kind of like Adventure Time.
I like Adventure Time, too.
I haven't ever watched Adventure Time.
What's the Adventures of Duckman?
Duckman was 90s.
90s?
Yeah.
So I thought that was great.
Yeah, Duckman was great.
And we're, critic. Powerpuff Girls was a good show.
Yeah.
So was Samurai Jack.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of got bored of the premise after a while.
I just like to watch it with the sound off.
Yeah, the visuals are great.
No, I'm serious. Like, you ever seen that show?
Mm-mm.
Like, it's amazing. Like, you can just watch Samurai Jack.
Oh, the Star Wars, the Clone Wars, the short one, that every episode was 5 minutes long. If we watch it, like, all together, it's amazing. It's, like,
wall-to-wall
action scenes.
Yeah,
it's
I've heard
like, the best.
But is that's after 90s, too, right? It's, like,
that was the early 2000s.
Yeah.
That's the guy who did Powerpuff Girls, like, Jenny Tarkovsky, I think.
Radical. Pop, pop, pop,